Brother David will now speak to us on the subject of Matthew 24.
If I don't speak loudly enough, make a face at me and I'll try to do better. If you have a Bible, it will really help to look at Matthew 24 because it's kind of a complicated chapter. We're not going to try to cover it all by any means. There's no way that that can be done in one discourse. Matter of fact, we'll probably just skip around and see some of the beauties that are in it. I think you all know that over the centuries, the Bible has had all kinds of interpretations made, everything from the ridiculous to the sublime. And when you get into chapters that involve symbolisms, it's the place that emotionally charged Christians have, without question, gone the farthest astray. And they have made out of these pictures some of the most ghastly and horrible things you can possibly imagine. But as we see the divine plan and how everything fits into it, the rational way that the Lord has used symbols is very appealing to us. This particular chapter, Matthew 24, is very frequently called the Lord's Great Prophecy because he uttered it just before his death, and it deals very much with what he wanted his church to know about events in the gospel age all the way down to its very end. It's a complicated chapter. Let's not start from its beginning, though. Let's skip around a bit. Maybe we'll come back to the beginning. Verse 32, Jesus puts a little parable in. This parable is very applicable to our day. He says, "Now learn a parable of the fig tree." Like we mentioned this morning in regard to the clothing in Eden. The fig is a symbol of the Jewish nation. So he wants us to learn some sort of parable, not about a fig tree, but about the Jewish nation. "When his branch is yet tender and putteth forth leaves, ye know that summer is nigh. So likewise ye, when ye shall see all these things, know that it is near even at the doors." Now that parable involves a couple symbolisms. First, the fig tree, then putting forth leaves. Now, when you see a tree put forth leaves, it tells you a couple things, doesn't it? It tells you what season it is. It also tells you the tree's still alive. Leaves are a symbol, apparently in the scripture, of a profession of life. It's a statement. I am alive. Now, exactly what that means has been subject to all kinds of interpretation. I think maybe in our historical time it fits best to say that that is Israel's statehood. Because that is when the nation said, "I am alive. Recognize me." As a matter of fact, in the book of Luke, this same parable is mentioned, and it adds a little fact. It said, not only to watch the fig tree, but all the trees. And I think all of us know that since the Second World War, there's been a tremendous explosion of nations wanting and getting their own statehood. And this is one of the symbols in this chapter that Jesus tells us we should be watching for. He couldn't come out and give us a date and say, "Here it is." But he wants us to watch this. He says, "Because you'll know that summer is near." Now, summer is the most pleasant time of the year. Some people may argue that. Mostly symbolically, though, there are two seasons, not four. You have winter and you have summer. And if you have to choose between the two, most people will agree that summer is more pleasant. And you'll find in the scriptures there's several kinds of summers. For instance, we'll even find earlier in Matthew 24, like verse 20, pray that your flight be not in winter, implies that you can be fleeing in the summer before the winter comes. Well, now, that's a different summer than we're talking about here in this parable. That's the summer after the winter. So we can have summer, winter, summer. Winter is the very bad part of the time of trouble that would be right here in the close of this harvest period. Before that, it's considered summer for some reason, because it's primarily because growth is still possible. No growth is possible in the winter. And then you see the fig tree putting forth leaves, you know that another summer is near, and that summer is a symbol of the kingdom. Now, sometimes it helps to compare other uses of the same symbol. In Mark, the 11th chapter, it's a very, very interesting statement. Starting about verse 12, Jesus was on his way back into Jerusalem from Bethany. It says, on the morrow when they were come from Bethany, he was hungry. And seeing a fig tree afar off having leaves, he came if haply he might find anything thereon. And when he came to it, he found nothing but leaves, for the time of figs was not yet. And Jesus answered and said, no man eat fruit of thee hereafter forever. And his disciples heard it. You notice it just drops it there. He goes into Jerusalem, and he casts the money changers out of the table, money changers out of the temple. And they start back on their way back toward Bethany. And they're passing the same place. And the disciples say, look, that fig tree we passed that the Lord cursed on his way in. You know, Jesus wasn't the kind of man who went around cursing trees. So there must be some sort of lesson in this. He was attempting to demonstrate a symbol, and it's the same symbol we're talking about. This is the nation of Israel down here, the first advent of Jesus. And he looks, and he says, well, you got a lot of leaves, a lot of profession, but no fruit. The nation of Israel had profession, but no fruit, and virtually Jesus was saying it's worthless. Well, they go in, and after they come out, verse 20, in the morning as they passed by, they saw the fig tree dried up from the roots. And Peter, calling to remembrance, saith unto him, Master, behold, the fig tree which thou cursedst is withered away. Obviously, Peter wanted an explanation from Jesus, didn't he? He got the strangest answer. Jesus, answering, saith unto him, have faith in God. And after he says, have faith in God, he says, for verily I say unto you that whosoever shall say unto this mountain, be thou removed and be cast into the sea, and shall not doubt in his heart, but shall believe that those things which he saith shall come to pass, he shall have whatsoever he saith. Isn't that a strange answer? If you were Peter, you would have felt slightly confused. Let's see what the lesson was. Remember, the fig tree was cursed. It was a symbol that the Jewish nation was going out. Jesus went into Jerusalem and actually took care of that, didn't he? He pictorially overturned the things of the temple that shouldn't have been there, demonstrating why the nation was being cast off. Peter said, look, it's dried up. Well, that's really the end of the story. That's the point Jesus wanted to make. The Jewish nation was drying up and ready to blow away, so to speak. But Jesus wanted to expand that. He said, virtually, the demise of Israel is not going to solve the problems of the world. I just cursed the fig tree and it dried up. But if you have enough faith, you can say to this mountain, and you can almost see Jesus gesturing with his hand, this mountain. What mountain is he talking about? There isn't any mountain there. Mountain, of course, in the scriptures is a symbol of kingdoms. Well, what kind of kingdom is he talking about? probably Satan's. If you have faith, you can say to this mountain, be cast into the midst of the sea, and it'll come to pass. He was attempting here to expand on the destruction of Jerusalem, because it was fruitless, to the destruction of Satan's entire empire, because it's fruitless. There's the wrong fruit. He was saying to his disciples, if you have faith, if you really pray and believe, thy kingdom come, thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven. You are praying for the demise of this mountain, just like I demonstrated the demise of that tree, and it will happen. Just as surely as that tree dried up, these mountains will be cast into the midst of the figurative sea, and that will be the end of the problem. I guess we ought to go back to Matthew 24. Jesus makes a statement after this fig tree parable. Learn a parable of the fig tree. Let's translate that. Consider a story about Israel. When its corporateness is putting forth professions of life, you know that the kingdom is near. So likewise, when you see these things I'm talking about, you will know that it, the kingdom, is near, even at the doors. He's saying this is the generation that should really watch for the establishment of the kingdom. And he expands that, and he says, verily I say unto you, this generation shall not pass till all these things be fulfilled. I bet you've heard a lot of discussion about that word, haven't you? This generation. I think Bible students have tossed it around for decades. Anyway, how long is a generation? I think Jesus explains it himself. On my Bible, you don't even have to turn a page to see where he explains it. On yours, you may have to turn back a page. He uses that word in chapter 23, verse 36. It's the same word in the Greek language. It's almost the same context, except it's being applied now at the end of the Jewish age instead of the end of the Gospel age. Let's read from verse 34 of chapter 23. Wherefore, behold, I send unto you prophets and wise men and scribes, and some of them ye shall kill and crucify, and some of them shall ye scourge in your synagogues and persecute them from city to city, that upon you may come all the righteous blood shed upon the earth, from the blood of the righteous Abel unto the blood of Zacharias, son of Berechias, whom ye slew between the temple and the altar. Verily I say unto you, all these things shall come upon this generation. O Jerusalem, Jerusalem, thou that killest the prophets and stonest them which are sent unto thee, how often would I have gathered thy children together, even as a hen gathereth her chickens under her wings, and ye would not. Behold, your house is left unto you desolate. He was standing there, we know the date, was in A.D. 33. He was pointing to an audience of his contemporaries. And he was saying, all these things will come upon this generation. When did it happen? The destruction of Jerusalem happened in 70 AD. From 33 to 70 is how long? 37 years. Now, I'm not trying to draw a parable, just trying to draw a parallel, just trying to draw a lesson. Within 37 years after he spoke that, it came to pass. Now, Jesus, when he spoke it, was 33 years old, which means 37 years later, he would have been 70. It would have been within a normal man's lifetime, according to the psalmist, who said that a normal lifetime is 70 years, and anything beyond that is grace. So, the promise of something happened to a specific generation doesn't make sense unless it happens to the people who are basically alive at that time. and the people who basically know what's going on because they're old enough to understand it. Now, I don't know what the average age of his audience was there, but suppose they were all Jesus' age average-wise. During their normal life expectancy, what was prophesied happened. Now, if we take that same thing over to Matthew 24, chapter 34, this generation shall not pass till all these things be fulfilled. We are saying somebody who was roughly 30 to 33, something like that, in 1948 when Israel became a nation, should expect within their normal lifetime to see this happen. Now, if it were an exact parallel, which would be 37 years, that'd be 1985, wouldn't it? It'd be great if that happened. We'd all be very happy about that. Now, it may be longer than that. We don't know. But I think generation, Jesus uses here himself. He uses it in the same context of both Advents. And his meaning seems clear. The bulk of the people who heard him speak during their normal lifetime would experience what he prophesied. So that's good news. That's one of the real good news pieces about Matthew 24. Let's look back at the beginning of Matthew 24 now so we get a little bit of the way the chapter is laid out. You remember in 23:38, Jesus said, "Your house has left you desolate." He had just condemned the Jewish nation. After he had done that, he and the disciples apparently went for a walk. And in the second verse of Matthew 24, he's telling them how his prophecy would be fulfilled. He said, "There shall not be left here one stone upon another that shall not be thrown down." And they apparently got to the Mount of Olives, and the disciples really wanted to know what he was talking about. So they asked him some questions. Verse 3. The disciples came unto him privately, saying, "Tell us, when shall these things be?" By these things, he must have meant the destruction of the temple, the destruction of natural Israel. "And what shall be the sign of thy coming," King James says. The Greek word is parousia, it means presence. Throughout the New Testament, the word is very faithful in its context, always meaning presence rather than coming. I think the disciples recognized that Jesus' second advent would not be visible. "And of the end of the world," it says in the King James. The Greek word for world is aeon, the end of the age. So they were asking him three questions, which we can pinpoint on the chart of the ages. When is the temple going to be destroyed? What will be the sign of thy second presence? And when is the end of the age? Remember back in Matthew chapter 13, Jesus gave a parable. And in explaining the parable, he said, "The harvest is the end of the age." I think there again, King James says the end of the world. We have on here harvest. But because Jesus himself said end of age or end of world equals harvest, we can plug that into the disciples' question here and make an equal out of it. What is the sign of thy presence and of the harvest? End of the world, end of the age, is the same as saying harvest. Now, Jesus answers all three of those questions, but the Apostle Matthew doesn't record everything that he said. Luke records part of it. Matthew records part of it. And you have to put them all together to get the answer. And we're not going to do that this afternoon. But I just want to make one point out of that. In the book of Matthew, the first question is never answered. You have to go to the book of Luke to get the events surrounding the destruction of the temple. And they're very similar. They're literal, and in their symbolic parallel, the same thing happens over here. But they are not identical. So in the book of Luke, he deals, he says, when you see Jerusalem compassed about with armies, flee, and so on. He is dealing with the destruction of Jerusalem then. He says something different in Matthew 24, because in Matthew 24, he never answers that first question. He only answers the other two. What is the sign of thy presence and of the harvest, the end of the age? Now, verses 4 through 14 of Matthew 24. To understand this, and this is probably, let me put it this way. Do any of you ever flip on a radio and hear a minister preaching? Now, you may flip it off right away, I don't know. But if you ever flip it on and hear a minister preaching, very frequently when they're talking about the Lord's return, they'll say, there's going to be earthquakes and famines and everything else. They're applying that down here. The point I want to make from this scripture right now is that that's an improper application. Those things do not apply about the Lord's second advent at all. These verses 4 through 14 that we're going to look at, which mention all of these horrible sounding things, were a prophecy about the bulk of this gospel age, not about the end of it. Because the first point Jesus wanted to make to his disciples was, you've got to wait. Patience. A lot of things are going to happen before there's an end of an age. That's the first lesson Jesus makes in these verses. Now, we're going to read them, not by any means comment on all of them today, but 4 through 14, let's break up into two sections. 4 through 8, first of all. In 4 through 8, Jesus is going to talk primarily about events in the secular world. I'm going to put this up on the board. And 9 through 14, he is primarily going to talk about events among the disciples or the religious world. Let's see how that fits. 4 through 8. Jesus answered and said unto them, take heed that no man deceive you, for many shall come in my name, saying, I am Christ, and shall deceive many. You know, that happened. Probably, if you were to pinpoint any point in history, since there was such a thing as Messiah even known about. Christ means Messiah, by the way. It's the Greek equivalent. There were more people pretending to be Messiah in the early days of the Gospel Age than any other time in history. And a lot of people, particularly Jews, fell for it. And they followed them, and it got them in trouble. This is an important lesson because Jesus, in this 24th chapter of Matthew, makes a similar statement to the one I just read. He makes it three times, but it's slightly different each time. Notice this. Verse 5 said, many shall say, I'm Messiah. Verse 11 says, many false prophets shall rise and deceive many. Verse 24 says, there shall arise false Christs and false prophets. You see the distinction between all three of those? Then we ought to have that on the board too, and explain why this is possible. And you notice, as those three verses I read, they're spread out through the chapter. First warning Jesus says, and this is earliest in the age, there shall be many false Christs that shall deceive many. Why could that be? First of all, when Jesus was born, you remember the scriptures say,
only were in expectation of it. Everybody was looking for a Messiah. However, everybody didn't know who he was, did they? Therefore, in this period in history, any person that came along and said, I am Messiah, and could do anything slightly unusual, was believed. Somebody followed him. Many people were deceived, sometimes by the hundreds of thousands. There was one not too long after the destruction of Jerusalem named Bar Kokhba. He had hundreds of thousands of Jews following him, claiming he was Messiah. And there's, in history, just loads of them. It was possible for many false messiahs then, because nobody knew who the real one was except a select few. When you got down to verse 11, though, which brings you into the middle of the Gospel Age, the part of the world we're dealing with, the Western world, is now all, quote, Christian, unquote. Do you think you could have come along at that period of time and say, I'm Messiah? Who would have believed you? Nobody. Because everybody knew who Messiah was. So in the middle of the age, Jesus doesn't say there are going to be false Christs. He says there are going to be false prophets. You're going to have all kinds of versions about Messiah and his doctrine and everything else. In the middle of the age, you don't have new Christs. You have just all kinds of false prophets telling you about Christ, each with his own message. This verse, much later, down verse is that in?
24.
That's taking us way down to the end of the age here. Let me ask you this today. Today, is it possible that people are looking maybe for another Messiah? You've heard it. The Sun Yong Moon from Korea claims to be Messiah. He has a following. He doesn't openly say that, but he doesn't deny it when he's asked. Even in the Jewish world, there's the belief of some that the Jewish nation is the Messiah, the reinterpretation. It is now possible for there to be new false Christs to gain followings, because faith has fallen apart so much in the last century that new Christs are possible, and we know as a fact that they're starting to arise. False prophets are likely also possible now, because even though a lot still maintain who the original Messiah was, they're being led in all directions by all kinds of false prophets. So Jesus was very consistent with history here, only he told it before it happened. He shows, first false Christs, then false prophets. At the end of the age, anything goes. I got slightly off the subject, didn't I? I'm back here in 4 to 8. You might say, what's that got to do with the secular world? It had a lot to do with the secular world, because as far as Israel was concerned, which is the first part of this whole story, to Israel, church and state were synonymous. A Messiah was a national leader. He was political as well as religious. They probably weren't quite sure which he would come as. Okay, 4 through 8. There would be false Christ, saying, I am Christ, and deceiving many. And ye shall hear of wars and rumors of wars. See that ye be not troubled. See, Jesus says these wars and rumors of wars, that's not a sign of the end of the age. That can't be applied down to the end of the gospel age. That has nothing to do with Jesus coming at all. That's Jesus' way of saying, all during this age, you will hear about wars and rumors about other wars starting up. Don't be troubled. This has got to go on for years and years and years and decades and centuries. For all these things must come to pass, but the end is not yet. Verse 7, for nation shall rise against nation, and kingdom against kingdom, and there shall be famines, pestilences is spurious, and earthquakes in divers places. All these are the beginning of sorrows. That's Jesus' explanation of the gospel age in four verses. He starts with Israel and he goes out
to the rest of the world. Nations rising against nations, famines, everything that takes time. But that's not a sign of his presence. It's a sign only in one sense. He said, you have to wait a long time. Now he jumps back. In these verses, he covers the same period of history that he just covered here. But now he's focusing in on his followers and saying, I want you to know what happens to you during these couple thousand years before I return. Verse 9. Then, meaning at the same time, they shall deliver you to be afflicted and shall kill you. And ye shall be hated of all nations for my name's sake. And then shall many be offended and shall betray one another and shall hate one another. And many false prophets shall rise and shall deceive many. And because iniquity shall abound, the love of many shall wax cold. See what he says about Christianity? He's pointing out its slow decline over the whole gospel age till the love waxes cold. But he that shall endure unto the end, the same shall be saved. And this gospel of the kingdom shall be preached in all the world for a witness unto all nations. Can you imagine when the disciples heard that sentence? They must have known it was going to take a long time then. Jesus just said, the gospel is going to be preached in all the world for a witness unto all nations. What a tremendous job. That's not an overnight task. Jesus was making his point. There's a long time involved in these verses 9 through 14. And then shall the end come. Or, as we showed earlier, we can substitute, and then shall the harvest come. He's not talking about the end of the world. That's another misconception about this chapter. The gospel shall be preached in all the world for a witness, and then shall the harvest come. A new period of time. So a change. I haven't the vaguest idea when I started. When am I supposed to stop?
YouTube?
Oh, well, that won't work. What do we do? Start a quarter till?
No, you started about 2 o'clock, maybe 5 of 2.
Okay. All right, we've covered basically verses 1 through 14. Let me take verse 15 because it is one of the key verses in the interpretation of the entire chapter. Verse 15. When ye therefore shall see the abomination of desolation spoken of by Daniel the prophet stand in the holy place, whoso readeth, let him understand. Then he tells you all kinds of things to do. There is a big word in verse 15. When you therefore see the abomination of desolation spoken by Daniel. Before you can see, meaning understand, what Daniel meant about the abomination of desolation, a therefore has had to have happened already. What's the therefore? You see, every time you have that word, you've got to connect it with something that came before. Does anybody see it? What the therefore is? I'm looking for something much closer that you'll find in verse 14.
Bible Society?
Oh, you're on the right track. Quote me a word out of verse 14 and then we'll be in working shape here. Pardon? Witness? Well, let me ask you, is that true? When the witness has been given, you'll understand the abomination?
Well, the Bible had to be circulated first, which is what the Bible Society did.
That's true. Maybe I just see it differently. Here, let me put the word out. Then shall the end come, therefore ye shall see the abomination of desolation. In other words, it would be impossible to understand the abomination of desolation until... Didn't Daniel say that himself? Or God in Daniel? He said, shut up the book till when? Time of the end. Well, that's complicated, but there's some beginnings before this line. But basically, the Lord is saying the book of Daniel is shut up until the end. And so when he says, preach the gospel for a witness unto all nations, then shall the end come, therefore you will see the abomination, he's saying that book of Daniel is not really going to be understood until we come to this end period. And that's very important, too, because the book of Daniel has an awful lot to do with the Lord's return. And that's partly an answer to Jesus' question, isn't it? Or the question the disciples asked Jesus. They said, what's the sign of your presence? Well, one of the signs of his presence, or several of them, are locked up in the book of Daniel. He's saying you're really going to have to understand something about the book of Daniel before you can get the answer to this question that you're asking. All right. Now, following verse 15, everything in the rest of this chapter, which goes on to verse 51, has to do with the harvest period. Up through verse 14, it has to do with the gospel age. As you can see, there is more that could possibly be covered in an hour's time. So let's just take a couple little things. Let's look at verse 29. Immediately after the tribulation of those days shall the sun be darkened, and the moon shall not give her light, and the stars shall fall from heaven, and the powers of the heavens shall be shaken. There is a key word there, tribulation. And then it's followed by the phrase, of those days. Jesus is talking about trouble of some certain days, and he doesn't really explain to us immediately what days he's talking about. So we've got to look in the chapter to find out. Unfortunately, in the King James Bible, that word tribulation only occurs in this chapter one other time. Notice verse 21. Then shall be great tribulation, such as was not since the beginning of the world to this time, no, nor ever shall be. And except those days should be shortened, there should no flesh be saved. But for the elect's sake, those days shall be shortened. Now that verse, 21,
is talking about this trouble here at the very end of the harvest period. When we get to verse, 29? It says immediately after the tribulation of those days, and it describes some horrible things, doesn't it? Your initial inclination might be to say, well, it must be over here. But that doesn't make sense, does it? Because this dotted line is supposed to represent the beginning of the peaceable kingdom. So even though verse 21 mentioned tribulation here, verse 29 is not talking about after that tribulation. How do we know?
First of all, verse 9, if we read Greek, would be a big help to us. Let's look at verse 9. Then shall they deliver you up to be afflicted. You remember when that applied? We just discussed it a little while ago.
That was the experience of the church during this gospel age. Most of the affliction of the church during this gospel age came at the hand of a single institution. Anybody know which one? The Roman Church was the primary persecutor of Christians who didn't agree with it during the gospel age. Okay, so verse 9 told us, then, meaning during this same time Jesus had just talked about the gospel age, they shall deliver you up to be afflicted. If you read in the Greek, you would find that that word afflicted is the identical word to the word tribulation in verse 29. So he's saying, then they shall deliver you up to tribulation during this gospel age. Now what I would like to submit to you, and I'll prove it in a minute with another scripture, is that this is the tribulation that verse 29 is talking about. Immediately after the tribulation that the church has suffered during the gospel age, the sun will be dark and the stars won't shine and so on. Now other prophecies show us that this tribulation had a rather dramatic close about the time Sister Raffle was mentioning when the Bible societies came out, because the Roman Church's power to persecute was pretty much concluded when Napoleon embarrassed the papacy, 1799 and thereabouts. A couple years afterward, Bible societies sprung up. Abraham Lincoln grew up in a log house like this just south of the river. How did he learn how to read? He read a Bible. That was in the early 1800s. How did he get a Bible in the middle of Kentucky? Because the Bible societies were that active then. Right after that 1799 date when the Pope was humiliated, Bibles just flourished. They found their way to the backwoods. So that real affliction of the gospel age was coming to a dramatic close just about the beginning of the 19th century. Now let's look at a scripture that proves this to be true. The scripture that Jesus is quoting in Matthew 24:29 is from Joel 2:31. So, let's take a look at Joel 2:31. It's right after Hosea, which is right after Daniel. Let me read 30 and 31. I will show wonders in the heavens and in the earth, blood and fire and pillars of smoke. The sun shall be turned into darkness and the moon into blood. Look what Joel does for us. He tells us when. Before the great and terrible day of the Lord come. There's our proof for verse 29 in Matthew 24. That this moon turning, or sun turning to darkness, moon into blood, and so on. Jesus is quoting that, and he says that before the great and terrible day, the other time of trouble that Matthew 24 mentions. It's back here. In other words, that's past history. Matthew 24:29 is over and done. It's accomplished. History has recorded it. As terrible as it sounds, if we look at it literally, has already happened in symbol. I wonder I can't find it. I'm in the wrong book. Matthew 24:29. Let's interpret it now in terms of history. Immediately after all the troubles of the gospel age during which the church has suffered at the hands of the Roman Church, the sun, the gospel message, will be darkened. You ever read any people in the 1700s when they write letters? Whether they're religious, whether they're churchmen or not, people like George Frederick Handel who writes music, people like Isaac Newton who writes about physics, no matter who, they always sign their letters
your humble servant in Christ or something like that. Very, very religious. It's just wonderful. But it says a time would come that this whole sun, this whole bright shining of the gospel would be darkened. Now if somebody wrote a letter like that and signed it, they'd be laughed off the face of the earth. And just see the president of General Motors writing a letter to a senator and signing it, your humble servant in Christ. This wouldn't do, would it? And yet that was so common. And of course, the French Revolution happened just as this whole event was coming to an end here, before Napoleon humiliated the papacy. The French Revolution had a great rise in infidels, and they scoffed at the church. They scoffed at the Bible. This is the darkening of the sun. And the moon shall not give her light. Now, the moon is a reflection, reflected light from the sun. Apparently, it refers to things under the Jewish law, showing that there would, at this time, be no light coming from that sector either. And the stars shall fall from heaven. Now, a star is a little light carrier, isn't it? Light, of course, meaning truth. Teachers of truth fall from heaven, heaven being a symbol of the religious world. At this time, we see in the religious world ministers stop focusing in on great religious matters and starting to talk about poverty, about politics, about urban renewal, you name it. It becomes a social gospel instead of a religious gospel. And here, Joel and Jesus symbolize it as stars falling from heaven. And the powers of the heaven shall be shaken. That almost says it clearly enough not to have an explanation, doesn't it? If heaven represents the religious world, the religious world's powers have been shaken to the very foundations. The authority of the church or churches or whatever term anyone wants to use, it's gone. Very little influence. Oh, still around, still kicking, but very little compared to what happened before 1799. Let's, because it's right there, let's go into verse 30. Then. When's then? It's at the same time verse 29 was talking about. It's talking about the first years of the 19th century. Middle of the 19th century. The time when the stars are falling, the sun's being darkened. Roughly from the 1790s up to the 1850s. Just as a rough period of time. Then, verse 30, then shall appear the sign of the Son of Man in heaven. You remember one of those original questions in verse 3? What will be the sign of thy presence? This is the only place Jesus answers that question, in verse 30. And he answers it so subtly, that it's almost impossible to see what he's talking about. But now he's telling us a time and a place, saying, you asked what the sign of my presence is, I'm going to tell you the time and the place that you'll see that sign. You will see it right in here, sometime after the French Revolution, sometime when the religious world is losing its influence, and you will see it where? In heaven. You'll see it in the religious world. It just doesn't say what it is. I would like to suggest that that sign is the seventh messenger to the church. That's when he appears, and that's where he appears. He appears in the religious world, not in the political world, and he appears at that very time. And how do the disciples learn that Jesus is present? Because he told them. That fits the fact better than anything else.
So Well, Revelation told us there would be seven messengers to the church. And I think Jesus was saying, the way you are going to know that the Son of Man is present here is because there will appear in the religious world at this time somebody will tell you so.
I think later in the chapter, Jesus elaborates on that, because if you'll notice back in verse 45, he says, "Who then is a faithful and wise servant whom his Lord hath made ruler over his household to give them meat in due season? Blessed is that servant when his Lord, when he cometh, shall find so doing. Verily I say unto you, he shall make him ruler over all his goods." The implication is right there. That connects with verse 30. Jesus is expanding on the thought. He says, you will know I'm present because I'm going to send a seventh messenger to the church that will explain it to you. That's the sign of the Son of Man in heaven. Very interesting, the rest of verse 30. Again, if you turn on the radio, especially on Sunday morning, and you hear the radio preachers, what are they almost all saying? He's almost here. Maybe it's tomorrow, maybe it's next month, maybe it's next year. He's coming. You can see it here, you can see it there, and they give you all kinds of signs. It's very common, isn't it, when you turn on that radio and get the AM Sunday morning preachers. Look what verse 30 says. Starting somewhere during the time of the sign of the Son of Man in heaven, then shall all the tribes of the earth mourn, and they shall see the Son of Man coming in the clouds of heaven with power and great glory. That word is not parousia. That word is not presence. Beautiful contrast Jesus is making. He's saying, you will see the presence, the thing you asked about in verse 3. They will see me coming. What a contrast. The church will see the presence. The world will see him coming. And they do. They see him coming. They're talking about his coming all the time. And Jesus said they would see him coming in the clouds or trouble of the heavens, of the religious world. But they don't see him present. There is a great and wonderful distinction. Well, we're out of time. Let's close with a rereading of verses 34 and 35. Verily I say unto you, this generation, the one that saw Israel established, 1948, shall not pass till all these things be fulfilled. Heaven and earth, the religious world and the social world, shall pass away. This generation won't, but the religious and social world will pass away. And it gives another thing that won't pass away, his word. Just don't worry, if all of it's falling apart, summer is on the way. And if it's the worst of winter, you've got a lot to smile about. Because if you go out and look at the trees, the buds are all there. May the Lord add his blessing.
Hey, thank you, Brother David. I think we can all agree that that's quite a topic to try and take on in an hour's period of time. And Brother David was able to get through portions of it. We thank him for it. Gave us some more things to think about and put to use in our further study. Do you have a closing hymn? No? Does anyone here have a hymn they'd like to sing?
38.
Brother Jess, what were you thinking of? The what?
Thy grace in part.
Thy grace in part. Well, perhaps we could sing. Perhaps we could sing. But what was the one that you were?
238.
238. Okay.
Tell me what to do.
Yeah. What is the one that you went? Did you say 238?
I'll withdraw mine.
Okay.
Okay.
Yeah.
Which one? 208.
Let's sing 208. We'll sing all four.
afraid to say that.
It's short.
Love and greetings to our
good brother. All in favor, show up by the usual sign.